Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to The Critic podcast. My name is Jo Bartosz. I'm a journalist and regular contributor to The Critic. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Maya Forstarter. As listeners may be aware, Maya has been at the centre of a landmark legal judgment. Overturning an earlier employment ruling, last week Mr Justice Chowdhury found in Maya's favour, effectively protecting gender-critical beliefs in law. This has been welcomed as a victory for freedom of belief, speech and expression. So Maya, it's odd because whilst I don't think we've actually met, I've been following you for such a long time on social media, I sort of feel like I know you. Could you perhaps explain to our listeners what your beliefs actually are and why they're deemed to be controversial by some?
Yes. Hi, Jo. So my belief about sex is the ordinary belief that most people hold, that if you ask your mum or your grandma to describe to you the facts of life, that's my belief, that boys grow into men and girls grow into women, that men have the type of bodies that produce sperm and women have the type of bodies that produce eggs and can go on to get pregnant, carry a pregnancy, have a baby, lactate, and we're built to do those two things. And that doesn't mean that everybody has to do that, or that if someone is infertile that they're not fully a man or a woman, but that human beings come in two types which relate to sexual reproduction. Until 5 years ago, that was a completely uncontroversial view. And if anyone had told me that it would be controversial, I would not have believed it. And that's the view that I've got in trouble for.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, and just like watching your case unfold has had me on tenterhooks, particularly after the initial ruling, which deemed that very, ordinary point of view wasn't worthy of respect in a democratic society. How did it feel for you to be at the centre of that?
It's been like boiling a frog. It sort of started with me tweeting about sex and gender in relation to the UK government's consultation on the Gender Recognition Act in 2018. And then there was a kind of 6-month process of me gradually losing parts of my job until I lost my job, and then launching the crowdfunder, which brought me into the public eye for the first time, and then obviously losing, and the next day JK Rowling tweeting about it. So each step in that has been quite stressful, and each step has sort of brought me more and more into the public eye in ways that I had never planned. But at each step it was sort of obvious what I had to do next, which was to keep going, because it was an injustice for me that I lost my job, but then as I discovered, it was an injustice for thousands of other women who are mainly women but also men, who are frightened of speaking up at work.
Mm-hmm. And I guess sort of that must have been very difficult to sort of live with that hanging over you. What made you realise it was so important? What sort of gave you the impetus to take it to an employment tribunal?
So what happened was, when I lost my job, I didn't know that I had employment rights because I wasn't a full-time employee on a regular PAYE contract. So I didn't know that there was a possibility of going to an employment tribunal, but I just tweeted about the fact that I'd lost my job as part of a thread about, why I wanted people to think about this issue and write about it. There were feminist lawyers who were waiting for a test case. I didn't realize this, and they saw what happened to me and kind of came to me and said, you know, explained to me about belief discrimination, which I had no idea about, that there are laws about belief discrimination that protect people with religious views, but also with non-religious views, and that they wanted to test whether belief and lack of belief in gender identity could be protected as a belief. And so then, you know, once it got started, my email inbox, my DMs, almost daily now, I'm getting messages from people saying this has happened to me at work. Either I've been, you know, dragged through a disciplinary process for saying something like JK Rowling isn't transphobic, or I'm afraid at work for that if I say what I think, I will be reported and I will lose my job or my career will be damaged. So, you know, just at each step, it's sort of become more and more obvious how many people are affected by this. And I'm, you know, the poster child for it.
Yeah. And I mean, something that that I think organisations have been notable by their absence in a way. So it strikes me that in very general terms, it's men who make women unsafe. So the right to say, I need a single sex space is something that obviously primarily impacts upon women. Do you feel let down by the mainstream feminist organisations that have sort of not publicly supported you and have stayed fairly quiet on this topic?
Absolutely. I feel let down by mainstream feminist organisations like Fawcett Society, you know, the Women's Equality Party, let down by human rights organisations, and even the kind of meta organisations that, you know, that are not campaigners, but are there to study and analyse what's going on. So the kind of business and human rights organisations that ought to at least be paying attention to this and saying, you know, there's a controversy here. What are the different sides? What are the issues? And instead, there's just been silence from all of them, both from the campaigners and the commentators. And clearly, I mean, I know because I talk to people, there's fear inside all of those organizations. So those organizations that present themselves as being about courage and being about speaking truth to power, when it comes to it, they've been missing in action. And that's what makes it so dangerous for anyone else to speak up. You know, if when I was losing my job, if I had been able to point at the Fawcett Society and say, look, they've done a webinar on this, they've hosted a panel, you know, they didn't even have to solve the problem. But if they had shown that it is respectable to talk about it, if, you know, the Royal Society, if, you know, the places that host debates and dialogue in society had shown that this was a respectable discussion to have, then it wouldn't have been so dangerous for individual women putting everything on the line to try and have a debate about what does self-ID mean in relation to women's prisons or in relation to women's refuges? What does it mean in relation to workplace facilities where, you know, firefighters sleep in dormitories together? Mm-hmm. And all of those situations, you know, they're quite out of sight and out of mind for people who work in NGOs, who work in offices, who don't, you know, are never going to be forced to share a bedroom or a shower or a locked mental health ward with somebody with a male body, or they don't think they will. And so it's quite easy for them to say, be kind, you know, trans women are women, there's no problem, there's no risk. And by them not stepping up and not saying, actually, there is a risk, let's look at it, let's consider what the trade-offs that are being made are, they made it, you know, just hugely dangerous for anyone else to talk about it. And then they'll point at it and say, oh, it's a toxic debate. But it's toxic precisely because those organisations haven't done their job and haven't made it a safe space.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I totally appreciate where you're coming from with that. And I guess I'm interested to know how you came to hold the fairly obvious belief that you do. I don't think it's a particularly remarkable belief, really, to acknowledge that there are two sexes and that it's impossible to change sex. but you know, how did you ever sort of get swept along with the be kind narrative, with the trans women are women narrative, or has your sort of background, because I know you have a background as a feminist campaigner, did that perhaps sort of inoculate you from some of the worst of the wokery?
I think, well, my degree is in agriculture. I'm quite down to earth, and I'm, you know, a sort of biology is, you know, my underlying thing is biology, and evolution is how I understand and explain the world. And so, you know, sex, people come at this from a humanities background, tend to think about sex and race as being similar kinds of things. And we think about fairness in terms of race, and we think about liberation movements in terms of race. And then we think that the principles of that can be applied equally to sex. And sometimes they can, you know, you can, progress that's been made in one liberation movement or in one civil rights movement can, you know, can be used and harnessed for another. But sex is just completely different kind of thing to race. You know, race is only skin deep. It only developed relatively recently when, you know, human beings kind of spread out around the world into different climates, whereas sex goes back to, you know, the very first sexually reproducing cellular organisms. You know, it's way before anything that looks anything like human beings. It's so deeply ingrained into life. And so I am a feminist, but underlying that, I believe in biology and science. So that's kind of where it came from. And then I think I hadn't, you know, thought about it very much. And, you know, I understood there are transsexuals, there are transvestites, and people should be free to live their life as they choose. And the questions about, you know, what do you do when somebody's desire to live as the opposite sex comes into conflict with members of that sex, you know, particularly on sport, but also in things like prisons and women's refuges, where, you know, people have nowhere else to go, or they're forced to be there. Kind of thinking through that stuff, I think, takes some time, and people have to think about what do we, you know, obviously there's this whole question about what is a woman, but also what is trans. And people talk about trans and they think they're talking about a fully medically transitioned transsexual, but often, you know, often, as we know, it's not. And in practice, it would be rude or illegal to ask. And so then you have to think about, I think, how, you know, how do you organize society in a way that gives people safe, clear, unambiguous, single sex spaces and services where they're needed, but that also cater for people who can't, you know, who can't be accommodated in spaces for their own sex, and who may want to be accommodated in spaces for the opposite sex, but we will have to say no, because, you know, you can't do both. You can't have a space that is single sex and is also mixed sex. And the question of where do you draw the line, I think, needs to be really opened up and looked into. And, you know, so I can't say I kind of came into this with all of the answers, but what I came into it with was the idea that when you have a difficult set of social questions, you have to be able to look at them and to talk about them without people being shouted at and being made to fear for their livelihoods.
I mean, why do you think it is such a taboo topic? I mean, it seems to have almost sort of come out of nowhere in the past few years, and just to have an absolute stranglehold on everything from, well, international NGOs to the media.
Yeah, I think at the heart of it, that you know, there's been this massive growth or rapid growth in transitioning children, and the part that's most difficult to talk about is the transitioning of children and the impact on children. And you get the biggest pushback, I think, when you try to talk about that. And we've seen that with you know, the whistleblowers of the GIDS gender identity development service at the Tavistock, trying to say, hold on a second, you're taking children who appear to be you know, kind of proto-gay and lesbian children, you know, same-sex attracted, working out what their identity is and what their sexual orientation is, or before they've worked it out, but feeling different, and being told you're in the wrong body and we can fix it, and if anyone disagrees with this, they hate you and they want you dead. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just an incredibly destructive kind of, well, I'm going to say youth movement, but it's not a youth movement. It is, you know, it's being you know, imposed on and promoted to children, and a lot of, you know, when I started talking about this and writing about this, I wasn't really talking and writing about that side, because I could see that there were other people who were much more qualified than me doing that, you know. Stephanie Davies Arai at Transgender Trends,
fabulous.
You know, all the people, you know, and the doctors and the therapists and people who had specific knowledge about child development and so on. And I wasn't talking about that. All I was talking about was, can we have a space for the debate? But I think the closer and closer you get to the impact on children, the harsher the response is. And, you know, it does make me think about, you know, the Catholic Church, Scouts, gymnastics, all of the institutions that have been historically corrupted to protect child abuse, and who have a you know, who protect themselves as institutions first and foremost, and where you have had whistleblowers or where you've had people raising the alarm about children being, you know, being put at risk, organizations tend to protect themselves. And then you have a scandal, and then you have an inquiry, and you have lessons learned, and we say this must never happen again. And it's just happening again with a different a different facade on it.
I totally know where you're coming from with that. And I mean, something that I thought was perhaps significant was that I understand the employees who complained about your tweets were based in America, and that your solicitor, Peter Daly, so he wrote a beautiful post on LinkedIn, and he observed that social media companies have put a scold's bridle on European free speech. So do you think perhaps this is a US import to some degree, the ideology? And do you think social media companies in particular will now perhaps be forced to rethink, in light of your ruling, the sorts of discussions that they allow on their platforms?
I do. I definitely think, you know, the debate and the shutting down of the debate in the US is so much more fierce than in the UK, partly, I guess, because that's where the ideology developed from, but also because there hasn't been a effective resistance in the way that there has been in the UK. And social media companies are covered by the Equality Act. They will have to rethink what they're doing in terms of, you know, people getting thrown off of Twitter for saying that men are not lesbians. Mm-hmm. You know, it's madness, but it's true. And you know, and being thrown off social media is, you know, it's a big deal for, you know, well, I mean, it's part of how people earn their living and yeah. make their participate in a democracy, particularly, you know, now we've all been locked in our houses, but the, you know, people being thrown off social media for disagreeing with gender ideology is now, I think, shown to be against the Equality Act in the UK. And interestingly, the judgment, it's a UK Employment Appeal Tribunal judgment, but it drew quite heavily on the European Declaration of Human Rights on Article 9 and Article 10, freedom of belief and freedom of speech, and how that relates to Article 17, which is about not undermining other people's human rights. And so although the framework of it was the Equality Act, the underlying framework was the European Convention on Human Rights, which means that this judgment will be influential across Europe. And so I think, you know, it may take some time, but I do think the social media companies are going to have to rethink what they do.
Excellent. Yeah. And I guess with regard to just ordinary workplaces across the UK, what do you think the ramifications of the ruling will be? You said that you were contacted by quite a few women in particular who had been silenced at work. Do you think this will sort of filter throughout workplaces, or do you think it will take quite a long time to unpick some of the misinformation that organisations like Stonewall have been accused of spreading?
I think it's having an immediate effect in that people already feel kind of relieved that there is this clear statement in law that belief that sex is real and lack of belief in gender ideology are both protected. And because often what happens in a workplace, if they're not sort of actively stonewalled, is that or they're not you know, actively promoting this ideology, is that somebody says something and somebody else complains, and then the decision makers are sort of lost. They don't know where to turn for clear benchmarks, and then, you know, they just want the problem to go away. It's not that they're ideologically captured, it's that they are afraid themselves and they don't understand the issue, and they panic. And so I think in those situations, women who are speaking up, if a complaint comes, they can then point at my judgment and say, don't panic, this is what the Equality Act says. And at that point they can kind of diffuse the situation by saying, you know, there is a benchmark, there's a legal judgment, you don't have to take everything that somebody points to and says that's transphobic as being harassment. You can use your ordinary judgment, which which HR departments do all the time. They judge whether something is harassment in other contexts, but they've been told that even defending something against being said to be transphobic is transphobic. So, you know, yeah. they're in this trap, and they, you know, often the person whose desk it's landed on has no idea and doesn't want to offend anybody, and sees that the and often it's not a transgender person who's complaining, but it's, so you know, it's an ally, or it's somebody who, you know, and frankly it's somebody who's seen that this is a way to bully and bully and harass women. And so I think, you know, all of those cases which don't come to court but which end up with women, mainly women, but you know, also some men, you know, going through these investigations at work, you know, where like Johnny Best at Huddersfield University went through one and said, you know, the process is the punishment. And yes. You know, having something like that hanging over your head at work for months, and having people talk about whether you're a bigot or not, even if nothing comes of it, is a punishment. So hopefully this job will kind of shortcut some of those things, and then it will also, I think, make employers relook at their policies to say, are our policies discriminating or encouraging harassment of gender critical people?
What would you, I mean, I don't know whether you want to answer this, but do you have a message for your colleagues in America who sought to sort of, in effect, bully you for the beliefs that you held?
Well, I probably shouldn't, because the case is still ongoing.
Oh, gosh, of course. I'm so sorry.
So the people who complained, I don't know them. They were in Washington and we didn't work closely together. I think one of them, we'd exchanged one email about some funding thing. You know, they weren't close colleagues.
Yeah.
And they just had seen my tweets and responded, you know, that this is transphobic. And I know there were other colleagues who, you know, thought like me that sex is real. And there were clearly other colleagues who couldn't understand why it was an issue. You know, why is this the hill that you want to die on? Not that they disagreed with me, but they disagreed with making a stand on it. And, you know, I still, it's one of the things about this that I still kind of puzzles me, is how an organization that was all about debate and evidence and kind of collegial disagreement, and often quite robust collegial disagreement. These were, you know, I worked with economists. They're really hard-nosed people. They will put price on your granny for you know, with good intentions.
Yeah.
They, you know, they don't shy away from definitions and sort of being hard-nosed in the pursuit of social good. But on this topic, they sort of institutionally threw their hands up and said, you know, we can't say what a woman is, when clearly they understood.
Of course, but they did.
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess it's quite concerning in a way that it's an international think tank sort of devoted to development. So presumably this mindset and their policies are going to be exported across the world. Is that something that do you think's happening?
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, the organisation I worked for was not promoting gender ideology. It was just trying to keep its head out of the debate altogether. Mm-hmm. But its funders, so, you know, the NGO funder complex is quite important in this, I think. So foundation funders, philanthropists who fund think tanks, who fund academic institutions, and who fund you know, operational charities, from women's refuges, international development, you know, even environment, you know, all of these things are there are women everywhere. And so all of these organizations think about gender, by which they mean sex, but mm-hmm. some of them are also pushing gender identity ideology. And if a funder makes it a either explicitly a condition of their funding or implicitly, you know, that it's frowned upon for somebody to question this, then that's very powerful on institutions that, you know, I mean, keeping the lights on, keeping the funding coming in is their number one consideration. And so I think, you know, the role of foundation funders on NGOs and, you know, campaigning NGOs like Amnesty International and the women's organizations we talked about is hugely important. And organizations like that, they, in order to succeed, what they want to do is to punch above their weight, to, you know, to have more influence than their budget and their number of people suggest. That's, you know, they want to influence bigger institutions. And if you can get an idea into those organizations, then you can accelerate it and you know, sort of drive it into all kinds of policies internationally. And you know, and the driver of funders with money leads to all kinds of you know, leads to a response from grassroots organizations who are chasing the money, and suddenly everyone's saying, we don't know what a woman is.
Yeah.
And all this has come, you know, like 5 minutes after Me Too, 5 minutes after they recognized that institutionally they've not been listening to women, they've not been thinking about you know, just widespread sexual harassment and sexual abuse of women in, you know, across the development sector, across Hollywood, across mm-hmm. the media, across corporations, you know, and it's literally kind of 5 minutes after that was recognized, now we're saying we don't know what a woman is, and if any of them speak up, they're witches and they should be, you know, ducked in the pond.
Yeah, and I've noticed there seem to be a set of beliefs that are getting promoted together. So the anti-carceral justice movement seems to be very popular, decriminalisation of prostitution, within full decriminalisation, so, you know, pimps yeah. and punters. I've noticed all of these sorts of things seem to be very popular within those who fund sort of development agencies and NGOs. I've seen that Center for Global Development had funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, from the Open Philanthropies Society. So I'm just wondering what you think, why are these funders tied to these very kind of quite niche ideological concerns?
I think, I mean, I'd love to talk to Bill and Melinda, obviously separately now. you know, I'd love to talk to George Soros to understand what it is he thinks he's doing here with his money. My experience of, you know, working for not-for-profit organizations and working with funders is that they don't always, you know, it's actually quite difficult to give away money. You'd think it'd be the easiest job in the world, but it's actually very difficult because people, as soon as you have money to give away, people tell you what they think you want to hear in order to, you know, every conversation you have is with somebody who wants your money, and it becomes very difficult to get good information and make good judgments. And you also become sort of captured by the people that you fund, because, you know, you want to feel that you're doing good, and so the people that you fund are categorized as being good, and then you can lose judgment about them. And at the same time, you don't want to be this auditor, you know, kind of big brother of the organizations that you're funding. You know, you want them to do what it is that they're good at. So I think, you know, there are whole loads of dysfunction in the funder NGO complex, and it's hard to know whether this stuff goes right up the top in all of these organizations. Certainly, I'm sure it does in some of them, but in others, I wonder whether, you know, one part of the organization is driving gender ideology, another part is thinking about women's rights, and another bit is thinking about democracy, open democracy, and they're not connecting the dots, and they're not thinking this ideology that we're driving is so elitist, it is so disconnected from what ordinary people believe, that the only way to make it go through is to dismantle democratic dialogue and democratic oversight and systems. And so organizations like the Soros Foundation, which say, and, you know, which I think, you know, genuinely are trying to promote an open society, particularly, you know, in Eastern Europe and in mm-hmm. You know, in countries where there are very strong challenges to democracy and freedom, are then kind of hitching their wagon to this crazy ideology which leads you to undermine everything that you stand for. And, you know, and then they say, well, those who criticize gender ideology are on the side of the right and the religious right. But in practice, I think they're driving people into the arms of the religious right in those countries, because if, you know, if the alternative is somebody who's going to come along and say, you know, smash the cis normative heteronormative family, most people value their cis heteronormative families, you know, whatever their own sexual orientation is. Everybody loves that, well, not everybody loves their mum, but mums are important. You know, families are important. Human beings are produced by cis heteronormative reproduction at the end of the day, and people should be
and mothers
and mothers, and you know, the kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater thing, I think, does drive people into the arms of religious conservatives, because it's the lesser of two evils for them.
Absolutely. And can you tell me a bit about Sex Matters, the organisation that you've just set up?
Yes. So I've set up Sex Matters. It's a not-for-profit in the UK. Its aim is to re-establish clarity about sex in law and policy, language and culture, particularly to push back on the adoption of self-ID, which is what we discovered through the debate about whether the law should be changed to allow people to self-identify, so to change their sex at will, was that even though that hadn't happened in law, it had happened in practice through policies and institutions acting like that was the law already, and doing it, you know, because Stonewall and other organizations have encouraged, bullied, misinformed them to do it. And so we felt, so the organization's been set up by myself and two lawyers and a biologist, that there needed to be a single issue non-partisan campaign to kind of bring back clarity about sex. And it builds on and works with, you know, there's been this flourishing of feminist activism in the UK as the established organizations have failed us. There's been this incredible flourishing of grassroots action, and we're sort of building on that, but also going beyond it in terms of wanting to build an organization that has capacity, and that also doesn't necessarily, doesn't belong to the left or the right, doesn't belong to any particular school of feminism, is really just about the very basics of, can we talk about material reality? Can we talk about sex? Can we work out the solutions to what you do with single sex services, how you protect everybody's rights? And to do that with, you know, with ordinary language about sex that everyone can use.
Excellent. Well, that sounds great. And finally, may I ask you, would you do it again?
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. Oh, well, thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else that you wanted to add or that you feel I could have covered that I haven't?
People can find Sex Matters online at www.sex-matters.org and join the email list, support us, come to our events. We need to have more and more people feeling brave enough to talk about this, particularly at work.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time and congratulations and good luck on when the trial resumes.
Thank you, Jo.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.